Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, where we give voice to the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women and non-binary scholars with doctoral degrees. I'm your host, Dr. Ijeoma Kola, and today we're joined by Dr. Jamaica Anderson, with a PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Dr. Anderson is a visionary educator specializing in critical digital media literacies among Black girls. She's the driving force behind the Black Girls Film Camp, an innovative initiative providing high school Black girls across the U.S. with a transformative 16-week experience to pitch, develop, and produce their own short films. The founder of I Am Not the Media, Inc., Dr. Anderson's impactful work extends beyond the camp. She's a project manager for the National Association of Media Literacy Education and a project fellow for the Cyber Citizenship Initiative with New America. With features in Wired magazine, The New York Times, and NPR, Dr. Anderson's dedication has garnered awards like the Crowning Achiever Award from the Crown Jewel North Carolina Lynx. Welcome to the show, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're excited to have you too. I want to know a little bit about you, where you're from, where you currently live now, and when you are not working and getting Black girls to develop and make their own films, what do you like to do?
Oh, okay. Well, the first part is very simple. I am from Charlotte, North Carolina, born and raised, and I am still at home in Charlotte, North Carolina. I love Charlotte. I'm a Charlotte girl. I've been to cities all over the United States, and I just wouldn't change it for nothing. So I am a Charlotte girl. And so what I'm doing outside of Black Girls Film Camp, you can typically find me writing poetry. I'm a poet at heart. I've been writing since I was maybe like 6 or 7 years old. Fell in love with Maya Angelou when I was younger, and then really fell in love with Nikki Giovanni, and started doing spoken word in college and performing in front of an audience, and published 3 books now of poetry. So that's what I'm doing typically when I'm not doing Black Girls Film Camp, which still is a form of Black Girl Literacies
when you look at it. It absolutely is. So how did you become interested in film and urban education? I'm kind of curious how these two things, like, where did the love for film come from and the love for teaching Black girls film, but also the love of education? Where do those, like, what were the roots of those?
Yes. Yeah, so I would say the love of film, that was been there my whole life. I grew up as a child of Blockbuster in the 80s and 90s. And so, like, movies and cinema has always been embedded in me, even with me and my friends. When we get up, we're having a movie night. Like, so I've always been a lover of movies and film. And then even I was a Barbie girl, and I used to put together my own productions growing up. So, okay. You know, I would say I always had a love for that. It wasn't until after I graduated with my bachelor's is in human development and family studies. I'm a first generation college student, didn't know what I was doing in college, just knew I had to go and be the first. But once I got out, I had been doing a lot of programming and working in the nonprofit space with youth, with teenagers, when I still technically wasn't too far off from being a youth. And just saw a huge connection with youth through media, through music, through film, through movies. But then also was seeing how it was shaping the youth that I was serving at that time, their lives, but also shaping my life, as how it has shaped my life and was still shaping my life as well. Right. And so that's when I started doing media literacy, but at the time didn't know that that was the term. I just knew I was wanting to sit down and analyze lyrics and unpack it and discuss, like, what is the hidden and unhidden messages in the song, or what are the messaging from this commercial or this advertisement. Just really became obsessed with media construction and the messaging of media. And so eventually turned it into an organization, and learned that I was actually doing media literacy, built a lot of relationships with media literacy scholars and educators on a national level. A lot of them wanted to start doing research with the programming that I was doing. Had no idea. Once again, just had the bachelor's, thought I had achieved all there was to achieve. I was the first to go to college. But when I started seeing, oh, okay, you can do research on this. Well, you all don't look like me, and why do you want to do research with the youth I'm serving that look like me?
Nope.
You know, and so that's when I got really intrigued to go back to school and majored in media education. And I did that at Appalachian State University and got my master's, and then pursued my PhD. So just backing up a bit. The work that I was doing with I'm Not the Media started growing tremendously with workshops where organizations, schools, Boys and Girls Clubs, Girl Scouts, anyone with youth were booking me to come and do workshops about media literacy with their youth. And so from that, I learned that media literacy, there's this component of analyzing, but there's still this component of creation. And so I started doing a lot of media creation work with doing podcasting, with doing video PSAs, short documentaries. And so there's this huge media creation piece, but also seeing the benefit of youth being a part of the process, feeling like they had a voice. Being active participants in the narratives that were being constructed, I grew a fascination in that, right? And understanding that now, wow, this tool where we're unpacking that has been used historically to oppress can actually be used to liberate, because these kids now have the authority, agency, and power to construct their own messages, right? And so I pursued my PhD and wanted to dive deeper in building out curriculum, learning how I can build out curriculum and target historically marginalized students through media literacy. And so that's how I landed in the urban education program, because that program was geared towards helping me really dive in and unpack theory and understand the constructs that have created the power structures that we see in our lifetime that have been embedded into the fabrication of our everyday lives in practices and ways in which we get engaged in the ideologies that we have no clue where they've come from. And so that program really helped prepare me to better serve historically marginalized students and leverage the connection between how media has been used as this ideological apparatus to continue to perpetuate systems of power and how we can utilize it to deconstruct it as well. Yeah. And so I kind of take that approach in theory with how I teach media literacy now. And so that's how the two marry.
Yeah, yes. Well, thank you for explaining. It's a perfect marriage, very beautiful marriage. I am curious, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your doctoral journey,
okay.
I want to know, because we often talk to people on the show who either have made a career pivot, if they have, you know, worked before going to grad school, and then they'll kind of do something different after grad school. When you went into the doctoral program, it seems as if you had a clear idea that you were going to continue doing the same kind of work. You were just going to do it with more knowledge and with more expertise. So can you just talk a little bit about how you thought of, at the beginning, before you even started the doctoral program, like how you thought about where it would change your, how it would change your career trajectory, if at all? Did you think about that at the time, or were you just really focused on, let me just get this, the theoretical background, the theoretical frameworks for how to continue doing the work?
Before I went into the PhD program, I had no idea what a theoretical framework was. Okay. So no. I just knew I wanted to be the one that's doing the research, and I wanted to enhance the work that I was doing, the curriculum that I was doing with the youth. And so once I got into the PhD program, I knew my focus was on media literacy and specifically working with historically marginalized students, or should I say critical media literacy, because media literacy and critical media literacy are two different frameworks, right? You have a critical kind of theoretical lens applied to media literacy that looks at systems of power. But so I knew I was going into that, in that route. I knew I was going that way without knowing the terminology or having the vocabulary, you know what I mean, to define what it was. And so when I got into the PhD program, I remember like my first semester in my cohort, I was hearing about other other colleagues in their like research, and I was like, oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. And I remember like, and you come in and you start getting pulled, like, is my work and my research that impactful? Should I really be?
Yeah.
Maybe I need to be over here, because this data they're talking about, they need some help. I need to help research this. And I remember meeting with an advisor, and she was like, do not get pulled, you know, like, keep your vision ahead. Like, what you're passionate about, stay in there, because that passion is going to create longevity. It's very much needed. It's very much necessary. The work, the need. You just need to, you know, read and do the research to back up why this is such a value and why it's so necessary. And so when I started diving in and learning about the theoretical frameworks and seeing the ties and the connections, you can't tell me there wasn't a case of why critical media literacy is needed. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And where the gaps lie. And so, you know, I was in the beginning kind of swayed, like, whoa, maybe I should be over here doing this, or maybe I should do this. And then, you know, a lot of students were doing a lot of research at the time, and it was really being pushed with us, like, publish, 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 to make yourself, you know, if you're trying to go out for the professor track. And initially I was thinking that might be a possibility, you know, based off of, you know, my advisor. And I was kind of, you know, when you get into the PhD program, they're trying to pull you in a little bit on that professor track. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe I need to jump the train. Like, let's be honest. When you go into a PhD program, you're dealing with a lot of imposter syndrome. You're questioning a lot of things about you and what you should be doing and what you thought you knew. And so I kind of fell prey to kind of like allowing a little bit of that molding to happen, where it's like, well, maybe I should consider the professor track, right? And so this is a true story. I started going along that route, and I was starting to be involved with like opportunity hoarding, like, okay, I need to do this. I need to build my CV up. I need to be writing. And then I ran into the block with the field that I'm in with critical media literacy. A lot of the students that were publishing, they were able to pull like publicly accessible data. And I'm like, there's no publicly accessible data on critical media literacy. I have to angle this thing a different way to get like, you know, National Report Card, NAEP data, or civil rights data. Like, how do I position this to write about it? And I don't want to reach too far to make the connection of critical media literacy. You know, I mean, I literally started going down the route of like tech inequity. Like, okay, digital skills, the connection between technology access, that I was like now kind of down here so I can write, you know what I mean? Just have something to write about, because I felt like I had to publish, I had to build my CV. Not saying that it was a completely bad thing. It did help build me more as a scholar to have that experience and figure out some of the connections, but I couldn't really dive deep on the critical media literacy side, because, you know, critical media literacy, it's not about quant, it's more about a qualitative kind of analysis, so to speak, with really working with kids and seeing how it's impacting them in ways that may not quantify. And so, and that's just usually how doing any kind of literacy-based educational research works, usually, like really diving in to see the sociocultural practices and how it's impacting them. And so I had to start realizing, like, Jamika, stay in your own lane. What happened to me is, with me trying to be what someone else was trying to make me be while I was in that PhD program, I was like having an inner body reaction to it. It was like, I don't like this. I don't want this. I was eating crazy. Like, I was stressed. I had started, when I tell you, I had took on so many opportunities, GATA. I mean, I was the graduate student counselor at AERA. I mean, I was doing the most. And I got to the point where I was like, I don't even enjoy this. I don't even like this. I enjoy doing my program. I enjoy creating experiences for youth. I enjoy working with youth, understanding youth. And I remember even having a conversation with my mentor, and I was like, people are starting to look at me like this expert, and I don't like how it feels. And she told me, she said, you're an expert in the work you're doing with youth. Just own that. No one knows your program, what comes out of your program, how youth are engaging, what you're learning from the youth in your program, like you do. And just own that. And so I actually had to do like a full circle and come back around and say, hey, I don't want to do professorship.
Yeah.
I don't want to do all of this extra stuff to build my CV. Let me just walk in my passion and my purpose, and everything else started just organically flowing, like speaking requests, invited speaking opportunities, invited collaborations, news opportunities. Let me just stay here, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Continue to operate in this path. And so I had to kind of have a full circle kind of situation. And it was kind of scary because, you know, I had been doing so much work with my professor at the time. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do professorship. Yes.
Yeah. So I feel like I relate a lot to the idea that you don't want to disappoint, especially if you're a first gen. And if you find a mentor or an advisor who you actually like, which is rare, but if you find one who you like, you know, there is an element of, well, I don't want to disappoint you. I know that you see so much in me, you know, they are enriching you. They are supporting you. They are, you know, increasing your confidence by telling you that you can do all these things. But it is also, as you mentioned, like really important to not necessarily go down the path just because someone says you should be a professor, because that's all they, not all they know, but that's often what they know, because that's their career. And so everyone is going to try to get you to their side of the table. But it's really frequent that people in doctoral programs, you know, heavily consider, as they should, they shouldn't rule it out, an academic career, because that's what their advisor has. So I'm glad that you were able to have a come to Jesus moment and just kind of assess all the different things you were doing and realize that you didn't have to be, as you mentioned, like hoarding opportunities and trying to stuff your CV to chase a dream that you actually didn't even want in the first place. So hopefully someone else is listening to that and can just take a moment, take a beat to reassess and evaluate whether all that you're struggling to do, or even if you're not struggling, everything that you're doing in grad school, are you actually doing it because you want to be doing it, or because you think that's what's expected of you for the next step? So thanks for sharing that. I want to talk a little bit about the specific program that you were in. So you mentioned that you're a Charlotte girl through and through. I love that. Was there something specific about the UNC Charlotte program that was really compelling, that made it the best fit for you? Did you explore other programs? You know, did you end up at the end of the day being happy with that decision?
Yes. So one, the UNC Charlotte program, I thought was going to be a perfect fit. Not was going, it was a great fit for me. It was an amazing program. But what really lured me into it was one, the program was ran by Dr. Chance Lewis, who is like phenomenal and is very renowned in the field of urban education, and he spearheaded that program. Additionally, I thought it was very intriguing that that program was predominantly Black scholars in that program. So I was like, ooh, what would it be like to be in a program with a cohort of predominantly Black scholars, right? And so I thought that was going to be like a culturally like amazing experience as well. And so that's why I was like, ooh, I really want to do this. Additionally, you know, I have a daughter, so I'm a single mom. I didn't want to leave Charlotte. My support structures are here in addition to me loving Charlotte. And most PhD programs are in person, and specifically the ones that I were looking at, like they were in-person programs. So it was just the best fit for me. And then also with UNC Charlotte being an R2 institution, I knew it wasn't, you know, with me kind of, I didn't have a strong research background like in my master's program, that I felt like it was a nice kind of transition from going from a master's program that was more heavy on practice versus research, for to ease me into research. And so, yeah, I thought it was a pretty good fit.
Yes. So what were some of the successes and some of the challenges that you experienced during your doctoral journey?
The successes and challenges.
Yes. So give us like one high and one low.
Success. Of course, the success is going to be finishing that dissertation in a decent time. So that was the high, was getting that dissertation knocked out. You know, I guess still got some colleagues still working on that dissertation. I'm like, whoo, That was a success, I guess, to get that dissertation done.
Well, how long did it take you from, you know, from courses and then, sorry?
I graduated in 4 years, so it was about a year and a half process because I took comps early. Like, I kind of sped through and ended up taking comps, and so I took comps actually in my second year.
Wow.
And then, yep, and then I really started cleaning up my proposal. I defended my proposal in spring 2021, and I graduated in spring 2022. And so,
Yeah, that was quick.
So, I another thing that helped me out with that was I could completely focus on that in the school arena, and I say in the school arena because I actually was built Black Girls Film Camp while I was pursuing my, when I was doing my PhD, and I was in the second year doing Black Girls Film Camp while I was doing my dissertation. So I say that, but I didn't have to do any GA, TA work because I received a dissertation year fellowship grant. And
okay,
so that paid for me to just focus completely on my writing when it came to school. And so all I had really was dissertation, and I could just focus on that, and then I had Black Girls Film Camp going on at the same time, which was amazing that the cards landed that way, because otherwise I would have been doing, working, writing, and, you know, managing and spearheading a national nonprofit organization at the same time.
Yeah. And so what were some of the challenges?
Well, I think I kind of spoke to this a second ago. I think challenges when you're a Black woman in trying to find the right mentor, and so you're trying to find other Black women PhD scholars in the in the university. And I was lucky for that. My last year in the PhD program, Dr. Anderson, who's like a mentor to me now. We're actually the same age, but she's was an overachiever and got her PhD like before she was 30. But, you know, she came in, she has all this experience, have been teaching, been a professor for like 6 years already, you know what I mean? And just, you know, but we're on the same, in the same generation, we can relate and, you know, speak to each other eye to eye, you know, and really she could mentor me in a peer kind of mentor way. And she came in my senior, well, I don't know, my fourth year. My fourth year, I think I'm still in high school.
Never heard anyone refer to the doctoral years as like seniors, but if you finish in four, then were a senior.
Right. And I work with teens all the time, so I'm like, fourth year, last year, senior year. Like, my senior year this mentor came out of nowhere, you know? Like, and she was a new professor that was brought in, and I kind of joke and say that she was brought in for me, even though, you know, that sounds a little bit egotistical, but I'm like, I think you were meant to get here for me. So she came in my last year into the program. She ended up coming on as my co-chair. But for those 3 years, it's like you really want to find like this. I know for me, I really wanted to find this Black woman, PhD, who could speak to me. And I had been searching for that. And then Dr. A came on the scene. Her last name is Anderson too, but I call her Dr. A. She came on the scene, first gen college student, all the things. And I was like, wow, this is really a really good match. And so I had struggled with that for the first 3 years. That was a challenge for me.
Okay. Yeah. But I love how I think you should just keep on saying that she came just for you. She was sent just for you. And it's really cool that it sounded as if she served as both a peer mentor and like a faculty mentor. And I haven't heard of anyone else being able to have that experience, but you get the best of both worlds. You get the camaraderie of someone who is around your same age, but also the authority of a faculty member being on your side. So that's awesome. That sounds like it was, it really sounds as if she came just for you. And I love that you were able to find that kind of mentorship before you completed your program.
Thank you. I am too.
So now I want to talk about your work. So
Mm-hmm.
you just wrapped up the 2023 cohort of Black Girls Film Camp a couple of months ago. And you guys do an all expense paid like weekend retreat in LA. So you take girls to LA. About how many girls are they? What do y'all do in LA? And how is this funded? It's just it's expense sounding expensive to me to fly a bunch of girls over to LA. But
Yeah.
love to know some of the highlights of what happens during the retreat and how it contributes to the development, artistic development of the Black girls who participate in the camp.
Yes. So the Black Girls Film Camp is a annual initiative. It's a 16-week program where girls from across the nation pitch a story concept, a story idea that centers a black girl, and the story needs to focus on an issue that impacts black girls in the United States, right? And so they pitch this story idea. We interview these girls. We probably get like over 300 to 400. It's ranged over the last year, 2 years, from 300 to 400 applications of interest. And we have to narrow it down because we only take 10 each year. So we take 10 girls between the ages of 13 and 18. And what we do is once they get selected, we help them through education, through training to develop their short films. We then produce those films and distribute those films. And to support them with developing those films, we contract out black women creatives to serve as a professional editor and creative coach for each girl. So each girl gets her own editor and creative coach. And we call it their production team, their Black Girls Film Camp production team. So there's this
Love
black
it.
woman that's helping to support the vision and all of her imagination and what's in her mind with this story and making her story come to life. Additionally, we provide them with technology. We have a lot of sponsors. We have a lot of sponsors. We can't do this, a lot of this stuff without the sponsors. So they get free technology. So Sony cameras, they get lighting kits, they get boom mics. Beats by Dre has been a sponsor. They get multiple pairs of Beats by Dre headphones. They get free software. Final Draft is a sponsor, which is the industry standard screenwriting software. So they actually get free software to learn how to build out their script utilizing industry standard software. They get Adobe Premiere for editing, and so they get all of this stuff for free. And then we also have advisors that help serve as industry experts that supervise the production teams and also kind of create this pipeline to serve as like a coach for the professional women, and also a resource for them and maybe where they're trying to get into their career, because our advisors are successful in the industry. So for instance, our post-production advisor, she won an Academy Award for editing Everything Everywhere All at Once. Is that the name of it? I think that's the name of it. And so yeah, she has an Academy Award. Like these women have really done the thing in the industry. And so they serve as advisors during the 16 weeks to oversee the production process of all the girls and their production teams. So in the middle of the camp, because we go through pre-production, then we go to production. And when we go to production, we then do the LA retreat, where we fly each girl and a parent, because we want to make sure the parent is involved and invested. So we fly each girl and a parent and her production team, which is her editor and her coach. So it's about 40 people we're flying to LA. And when they come to LA, we partner with USC Annenberg's Critical Media Project. It's a professor out there, Allison Trope, who I've been working with in the national media literacy community. And she was in love with what I was doing the first year with Black Girls Film Camp. And she was like, I really want to support this. Like, let's figure this out. And I'm like, well, the world is opening up post-COVID. I think we want to do an in-person retreat as a part of our production, like leading into the production process. And she was like, I'm on board. So this is an annual retreat. This past year was our second year going. We're now planning out the third year. But it happens midway when the girls transition from pre-production to production. We have partnerships for the girls to take trips. So we went to Array Creative Campus, which is Ava DuVernay's creative campus, where they do a lot of the production work for a lot of the projects that they work on. The girls got to meet Ava DuVernay, and we also partnered with Walt Disney Studios, where they got to tour their studio lot and they created like a customized experience and allowed the girls to have lunch with their executives. So they get to do all of that. They also have courses with USC professors, and they get to be with their production teams in person to work on their films in person, because everyone is nationally everywhere. So our sessions are virtual. So after that's done, they do, they're through post-production process, they have a film, and we debut it and have a premiere in no other place but Charlotte, North Carolina. And so the films are debuted, and then they go on a festival circuit. And so we have partnerships with festivals like Mill Valley Film Festival, Bentonville. This past year, we were at Essence Film Festival. And the girls get to attend the festivals and speak on panels and talk about their stories that they created in this program, but also just about the experiences of Black girls in the United States. So, yeah, that's kind of the camp in a nutshell.
Yes. Oh, such cool work. Stuff that I wish, I mean, I'm not even like that interested in, I can't like lie and say that I'm like a movie person or a film person, but I still wish it existed when I was a teenager.
I know. I was a teenager too.
Yeah, but that's what we do. You know, we create the things that we wish we had, and that's how we make the world better. I know that it's still, it's huge and has grown exponentially. But since you just said it's the second year, have you observed, do you feel like there are girls who've done the film camp who are, you know, going to be, have you identified the next generation of filmmakers? Like, do you already know who they are?
Yeah, so it's the second year for us doing the LA retreat. It's the third year. We just finished our third year with the camp. So we're now going into the fourth year. And so me and my co-founder, we were talking about that. I was like, whoa, 4 years. That's like senior year, right? Whoa, where it came from, freshman to senior, right? And so a lot of the girls are being impacted tremendously from being in this space. We also have an alumni program. So the girls, even once they finish with the camp, there's still a lot of great opportunities for them to stay involved. We have meetups on the regular. We have a IG chat, and then we just found out they have their own little text chat that they do where they don't want us to see stuff. And, you know, we also have created opportunities for them to serve as alumni coaches to help the next cohort that comes in. But these girls have utilized their films to get into film schools such as NYU Tisch, where Spike Lee is at, you know, and then, you know, you got your USC School of Cinematic Arts, which is, you know, sometimes they dispute whether which one is the top film school, right? And then we have other girls that have continued to put their films in film festivals and win awards on their film individually. So even though we have these partnerships to host the screenings, the girls can still submit their films into film festivals for awards and accolades. And I want to say, just even this cohort that just came out of 10 of the girls, 6 of them have already started receiving awards and selections into film festivals. And some of them have received more than one, like 3-4 film festival selections, and they just launched their films in June, and it's end of August. So yes, they definitely want to go and pursue film. These are the future filmmakers of tomorrow.
Today. I love it. Oh, I'm so excited. I like need to like see which films I can watch and how I can screen them. That's really exciting. So there's a lot of we will drop the website in the show notes, and that's what I will be doing with my weekend for sure. There's a lot of conversation right now about, you know, youth's exposure to media, youth's consumption of media, you know, typically focused around social media. But I'd love if you can speak a little bit to how media literacy can play a role in addressing broader societal issues, such as representation, identity, and equity, particularly for youth. And also how it can be kind of like a protective barrier against some of the more like negative and insidious elements and aspects of the media that we consume.
Absolutely. I mean, education in general is a remedy to a lot of the issues that a lot of people are subject and prey to, many of the challenges that we experience in our society because of lack thereof, of like lack of education on certain topics, issues. Media literacy education equips students to engage with media in a more active, participatory way, for them to become more critical and conscious to the content that they're engaging with, the messaging, the languaging, all of those things, and really be able to unpack it in a way where they're not just inactive consumers, where, you know, when you're an inactive consumer, or a lazy consumer of media, you're just watching it, right? And you're not even paying attention to how the messaging is shaping you. Media and messaging is you consume it just like you consume food. That's why we always say, like, what is your media diet? Because sometimes you don't realize you're consuming content, you're consuming messaging in your mental, it's impacting your mental health. But if you're an active consumer of media, you're constantly asking critical questions as you're engaging, or you're thinking critically while you're consuming. So you're asking yourself, like, who's represented, who's not represented, why am I not represented, what is this saying, what is this trying to sell me? Or even if it's not an advertisement, like, how is this group being represented, and how might this impact their perception on this culture group, or how is it impacting me and my perception? Also, it's making you think and engage in it in a more politically conscious way, because you start looking at systems of power and how they're being perpetuated in it. So you're looking at race, sex, sexual orientation, you're looking at gender, you're looking at all of that, and you're seeing how gender roles are being perpetuated. You're seeing how the construct of relationships and what that should look like. You know, for me growing up, I grew up in the 90s and hip hop, and for some reason I thought I wanted me a Tupac, but you know what I mean? Because that was idolized, and then I'm dating these Tupacs and I'm unhappy, and I'm like, what's happening? Why am I not getting what I want? Why am I not getting 90s R&B love? You know what I mean? Like, what I'm attracted to the Tupacs. Right? But then you got to start unpacking that a little bit more deeper, so you really start becoming more critical and understanding, like, oh, wow, this person is being reflected as something to be held of value. There's the value expectancy theory is a concept that makes us create value with some of the imagery we see. But then at the same time, what is that messaging saying to me as the young lady and to the man, which is telling him, like, you should have many women and you should have this persona. And so we're getting two different messaging with the same media. And it's that when you become this active consumer, you start asking these questions, right? And so you become more resilient to it. And then when it comes to social media and representations, a lot of young girls are being exposed to content to show them, to desire them to want to be thin. You're seeing hashtag body goals, you're seeing hashtag relationship goals, and all of that is doing is creating this social competitiveness in this space, and causing a lot of the challenges with social media and mental health, with depression and social media anxiety, and all of these things that now are new constructs, so to speak, that has impacted our mental health in ways before we even had social media. That is like, whoa, 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 whoa. We're learning, like, all the dopamine that's being released as we're engaging in content online and how that's impacting our brains. And so what media literacy does is allows us to sit down with students and really help them have those conversations. Let them know that they have agency and authority in these spaces. Especially in social media, you have agency and authority to shut something off. You have the ability to just ask yourself, how does this make me feel? That's a simple question that we rarely ask ourselves sometimes when you think of it. And it's really sad. Just, how does this make me feel? And once you realize, whoa, I don't like how it feels, knowing that you have the agency and authority to change it. Media is a construct, meaning it can be changed, it has been created, it can be recreated. And so that's what media literacy education does, is it teaches students that.
Yes. I know we're short on time. I have one last question. We ask all of our guests this question. What is one piece of advice, one final piece of advice that you have for prospective or current Black women and non-binary doctoral students?
Don't let anyone change who you are. Be true to yourself. Stay true to yourself. And know that the path that brought you there is the right path, and you can stay on that path. And if you do stay on that path, you will be successful. So that's it.
It's a mic drop moment right there. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson, for joining us on the Cohort Sisters podcast. Really excited to share your work and everything that you're doing with Black Girls in Media Literacy with the rest of the community. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great one.